Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Welcome to another edition of IGN Unfiltered, our monthly interview series where I sit down with the best, the brightest, the most notable and interesting gaming minds
and
the entire industry. I am joined by the great Vince Zampella. You're great. You've made some great games. We're going to talk about all of those. Vince, you, of course, you go back, let's see, Medal of Honor, Allied Assault. We'll get to that. That was, and then, of course, on to founding Infinity Ward and the Call of Duty franchise, little thing you may have heard of, and now on to Respawn Entertainment and the Titanfall series, as well as another little Star Wars thing
The
back burner, too. So, Vince, thanks for sitting down with me. We're here at your studio, by the way. Thanks for having us.
Got good
details. We appreciate it. Yeah, it's a nice backdrop. But I want to start, I always love to know, I mean, before the billion-dollar franchise, to me, the origin story is always super interesting. I think that's why superhero movies keep doing it. So I'm curious, where did you actually get your start in the games industry? Because in doing my research on you, the first game I could find that was credited to you was a PC first-person shooter called Vigilance, published by Sega in 1998. Is that research accurate?
No.
Where does the Vince Zampella story begin in the industry?
All right, so let's see. My first job in the industry was Game Tech in South Florida. They were in North Miami.
Didn't they make, like, the Jeopardy video and Wheel of Fortune video game
stuff? Jeopardy, Wheel of Fortune, Family Feud, among others. You know, we had Brutal Paws of Fury and I can't even remember some of the games. It's such a long time ago now.
And what was your role in those early projects?
I was producer slash customer service slash test. It was kind of like
everything.
Whatever
Everybody
needs to be done, you do it.
Did you always want to work in games? Because you went to art school, is that correct?
I didn't, no.
You didn't? See, no. I'm off to a terrible start.
I think I never realized it was a job. You know, I've always been a gamer. I've always played, you know, RPGs, you know, pen and paper RPGs, board games, you know, video games. It never occurred to me that that's something that people will pay you to do.
Yeah.
So the opportunity came up to work at Game Tech, and I immediately, like, switched into it and was like, well, yeah.
Did you game as a kid on either NES, Atari, one of those?
Yeah, Atari. I had Atari 2600 all the way. You know, I had a Pong system, actually, before that at some point, and then I had the Atari 2600. I had a Commodore 64. I had, what other systems did I have? PCs, of course, at some point. And
any childhood favorite games? Any ones that stand out from your youth?
You know, Donkey Kong is, for whatever reason, and it stood out to me as a game that I just loved. I would spend hours at the arcade playing Donkey Kong.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to argue.
It's a classic. It's a wonderful game.
So then, you know, big step up from Game Tech. We fast forward. You joined 2015 Inc. as a development director on.
Well,
Metal
I actually there were some steps in between there.
Okay.
So I went from Game Tech to Atari, actually.
Atari.
Yeah, I worked at Atari for a while, working on some of their Jaguar NPC games.
Jaguar. See, I had a Jaguar. I had Aliens vs. Predator is like my only positive memory of that system. So
I worked on NBA Jam.
Really?
For Jaguar. And Supercross 3D. I worked on Jaguar CD games, too. And there was only, I think they only manufactured like 5,000 of the CD units. So I have one at home. I should bring it in.
Yeah, that'd be cool to see it. So you don't get to, they're pretty few and far between at this point. So then on the 2015, or got a couple more stops?
Got a couple more stops in between there. I went to Panasonic. After that.
Boy, you know how to find the sort of obscure players in that early portion of your career.
Yeah, I guess so. That was Panasonic Interactive Media was the division.
Huh.
And they did, they were at that point when I joined, they were ramping down the 3DO.
Mm-hmm.
So they still had some 3DO games in production. Some I had to finish, some I had to kill. And then they were making the transition into try to be multi-platform.
Right. Yeah, the notoriously expensive 3DO console back then. Another one for the archives. If you've got one of those sitting around, that's a good one to hang on to.
I might, actually. I need to look. I need to open up the boxes in my garage that have been sitting dormant.
So then I went to
Sega.
Okay. And Vigilance.
That's right. Vigilance was at Sega. This was Sega Soft.
Yeah.
So moving
up the ranks a little bit.
We did a game called
Experience Under Your Belt.
Yeah. We worked with a guy named Larry Pacey, who I partnered with now on the mobile stuff. He and I worked there together, and he and I, you know, knew each other from growing up. We, mm-hmm. you know, gamed together for a long time. Worked on a game called 10-6, which was the million-player game. We never hit a million, though. Vigilance, and then there was a game called Skies.
Okay.
And Skies never ended up shipping because it was a massive multiplayer, and the budget went out of control, and that's when Sega was cutting some costs.
Right.
Then I went to 2015.
Okay, and that's where the modern Vince Zampella story begins, I think it's fair to say, because that is where you were working on, of course. You led the team on Medal of Honor Allied Assault, which really was the first significant sort of history-based first-person shooter, I think it's fair to say.
Maybe.
Or at least kicked off. If it wasn't the first, it sort of really got things going.
It was definitely one of the more popular, yeah.
So there was a rumor on that Spielberg approached you guys to do it?
So how it happened was Spielberg owned Amblin DreamWorks Interactive.
Yeah.
That was purchased by EA at some point. I'm not sure what the timing was there. So EA was working on Medal of Honor for the PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to do a PlayStation 2 version. They approached us to do a port of the PlayStation 2 version to PC.
Right.
We said, how about we just make a wholly unique game because we can do something better.
Yeah, a PS2 to PC port probably wouldn't have gone over super well at that point with where the first-person shooter genre was,
I imagine. That's right.
So you say, and you got them to, because that's probably going to cost a lot more money than just a port job, right? So you guys got them to say yes to that.
It would cost more, but not... I mean, at that point, we were a small team. We were only, finished that game with around 22, 23 people, I think.
Wow.
So, I mean, we were a very small, hardworking team.
So, my research has been awful so far. I'm already...
I like this, though, that the internet doesn't have me pinned.
I'm human. It's fine. Is 2015 where you met... your future longtime collaborator, Jason West?
No, actually, when we were working on that game, Skies, at Sega, we partnered with Paradigm Entertainment down in Dallas, Texas. Jason worked there.
Okay, gotcha. Did you guys hit it off right away?
No.
No?
No, there was actually some friction. I was the publisher, they were the developer, so there's always that, that...
Overlord.
Friendly fiction, we'll call it, But I appreciated what he did.
Yeah.
So I think it worked on some level. And then when I moved to 2015, I called him up to try to get him to come out and work with us.
And we'll get to that's sort of led to Call of Duty, and we'll get to that. But Jason now, he was at Respawn. He founded Respawn with you, and then sort of seemingly walked away and has. Actually hasn't been heard from since, and I mean, do you guys still talk at all?
We don't.
No. I'm sorry to hear that. It's too bad.
But, unfortunate.
Well, you soldier on here at Respawn. Let me stop for a second. When Jason sort of walked away, you guys had the big lawsuit with Activision and it did get settled, and we're going to get to all of this more later. But
sounds like fun.
Oh, it'll be a blast. But were you tempted to walk away too? I mean, terms of your settlement were never disclosed, and there I could only find various conflicting reports. But it's a multi-billion-dollar franchise, and were you tempted to kind of after everything that happened with Call of Duty, just say, you know what, maybe Jason's onto something. Maybe I just want to retire now too.
No, I've never really seriously considered retiring
just
because it's what I do. This is what I know. It's what I love. I'm happy doing this. I think I'd be bored.
Good. Well, I mean, we're Titanfall and now Titanfall 2. We're lucky to still have you around.
Well, thank you.
Uh, Well, let me back up to Medal of Honor. It kind of came out of nowhere as far as people weren't expecting it to be the incredible shooter that it ended up being. I mean, I think, you know, it had some expectations, but it obviously exceeded those. What made Allied Assault good, in your opinion, looking back?
I mean, for us, it was about taking something with historical context and bringing it to life in a way that, you know, made the world believable and kind of draws you into this story and into this world. It was about, you know, not just what's in front of you, but the world around you. We put things, you know, off in the background, you know, explosions and things happening and planes flying. And, you know, it was more of immersing players kind of in a story. And I think, you know, we were able to do that more successfully than, you know, than some other games.
So from there, you leave and form Infinity Ward.
That's
right.
Is
that correct? Was that just sort of a I want to start my own studio thing, or was there anything going down at 2015 where you thought, man, maybe this isn't the best place to grow my career?
Yeah, I mean, there was
2015's
some...
not with us anymore, I don't think.
I don't think so either.
If it is, it's certainly not in its, you know, at the status it was.
Yeah, there was some tensions kind of at the studio. It was obvious at some point that, you know, people were going to walk away. And we decided to all walk away together because, you know, we had a good cohesive team.
Yeah.
And it just felt right for us to work together again.
And thus enters Infinity Ward.
That's right.
Can you tell me where Call of Duty came from? Based on what you just said, was it an FU to Medal of Honor, or is that good of a story in it, or
a little bit? I
mean,
so originally when we formed Infinity War, we were working with EA. We had a deal to do the sequel to Medal of Honor. Allied Assault did so well that EA wanted to pull it in house, so they tried to force us to come be part of EA. We didn't want to do that. They tried to strong-arm us a little bit.
This sounds familiar. Sorry, continue.
Once they tried to strong-arm us, we decided, you know, we don't want to be part of EA as a team. We decided, you know, that wasn't what we set out to do. We ended up going and working with Activision, and yeah, Call of Duty was kind of a response to that.
Well, you got the last laugh on that one. So you've created two major first-person shooter. Well, I mean, three once we get to the present day, but...
Well, to be fair, Medal of Honor was already going. It was a PlayStation 1 game.
Because of Allied Assault, it went on to live a very long and pretty healthy life up through, you know...
I think Allied Assault was an amazing game.
It was great.
I was immensely proud of.
Remember it very, very fondly. So if there was a little bit of that, a little bit of the... desire for revenge, shall we say, but you know, the fact that it was another historically based first-person shooter, I mean, it's not, you know, a simulation, but it's, you know, based in history, did you just think that with Allied Assault you were onto something with a shooter that's set in history and that the sort of the marriage of those two things?
Yeah, I think it's on one hand, it's just, I mean, a great story. World War II is just clear minds of good and evil.
Yeah.
It's great stories. If you look at, you know, the outfits, especially, you know, of like the Nazi party, like they have the amazing outfits. They're, you know, the scenery is fantastic. It's all over the world. It's, you know, there's such great stories that come out of World War II. There's just, you know, the subject matter is just so great to work with. And then you get the historicalness of it where you can look at some of these stories and say, this actually happened. And you get to play something that actually happened. Now, it's not exactly as it would have gone down.
Sure.
Like you said, it's not a simulation. It's meant to be authentic, not, you know, exactly realistic, not a simulation. But just to be able to go to these places that you've heard of, that you've seen movies about, and interact with it, it's such an amazing experience.
So you guys, when Call of Duty certainly, it established once it got to Call of Duty 2 on the console and really sort of took off, but you guys made 60 frames per second a sort of core design element from a technical perspective, because I mean on the console side that just wasn't done. I mean, Halo was huge, Rainbow Six was thriving. Those were 30 frames per second, mostly presumably due to technical limitations on the consoles. But you guys really said, no, it's going to be 60 frames. What went into that decision? I'm curious.
It's just kind of a mantra of the team that animation looks better, the game plays better, the controls are smoother. You know, it's just the game feels so much better at 60. You do sacrifice a little bit on the visual side, but for what you get in terms of the game quality, it's worth it.
Was it an easy decision for you and the team, or is it something that you guys agonized over for a while?
No, I mean, you always question it when you look at, you know, could we make something look better or can we make it play better? You question it sometimes, but, you know, it wasn't agonizing, no.
Now, the original game was big, but as I started to get into it, it really seemed to rocket upwards when it came to the Xbox 360 as a launch title for 360. Did you expect that sort of the stratosphere, the roller coaster ride to really take off then? I mean, it was... The first game was very, very well received on PC, but boy, on 360, that's when it all seemed to really start to kick in.
Yeah, I mean, you always hope for that level of success. You know, you dream of it, but, you know, we had at one point like an 80% attach rate to the 360 at launch, which is, it's just unbelievable. So, no, I don't think you're ever prepared for, you know, for when it actually hits you.
When, you know, so that's huge. It's a launch title. And then what people, I think most people know, or at least most hardcore gamers know, is at that point, Activision doubles down on the franchise. They have Treyarch doing the off-year games when you guys are in development. So there are two studios, and so your next game isn't Call of Duty 3, but Call of Duty 4, that's Modern right. Warfare, which that's when things, of course, really got nuts success-wise.
Clearly, there was another team in the mix there, too, a team that came out, one of the Medal of Honor teams came out of EA and formed a studio to do a Call of Duty game.
Did it?
In between. Yeah,
It was... Oh, the Big Finest, Red one? Was that the...
No, that was, I think it was Finest Hour.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. So that's, there have been a lot of Call of Duty games.
There have been a lot of Call of Duty games.
But, so when we get to Call of Duty 4... Obviously, the big change, bye-bye World War II, we're into Modern Warfare. Can you walk me through, do you remember a lot about that decision? Because I would have to imagine that was discussed a lot. Because you've got a good thing going in World War II, especially even as Treyarch shipped their game. It's continuing in World War II. Leave it all behind, though.
I think the discussion wasn't necessarily internally at Infinity Ward. We wanted to move on. We wanted to do something different. You know, that was the third World War II game we'd done in a row. We were ready to change it up and do something a little different. The discussion, you know, became between us and Activision of, you know, should we switch? Like you said, it's a good thing.
Right.
Do you want to change the formula? And we felt really strongly. So we just kind of had to soldier on and say, this is the game that we want to do.
Did you get pushback from Activision?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, clearly you won, but was it a hard-fought battle? Or I mean, you'd think that they would trust you after you've created this big mega franchise, but I guess maybe that's publishers don't always see it.
Like
that
you
way.
Said, it's change is hard. It's risky, and they like you know they have stockholders that they have to report to, and they want to keep the formula going as consistently as possible.
Do you ever now? You know, it's after. Modern Warfare is 9 years ago at this point when again, I mean, one was great, two was huge, and then four was stratospheric. Do you ever stop and just maybe driving to work, do you ever stop and think, I made a $1 billion franchise? Like, is that ever a thought that just goes into your mind, or is it just either a part of your past or just too even surreal to process?
No, it's such kind of a part of common culture nowadays that, you know, like I'll just be watching TV or a movie or something like that and they talk about Call of Duty like it's, you know, like, oh, everybody knows Call of Duty. That's when it like hits you like, wow, you know, to be part of something that is just, you know, so well known and so out there in the world is just, it's a little unnerving, you know?
Were you, it was really, I mean, the single player, the campaign was great. There were so many just big moments in it. But really, multiplayer, I think, was the key to that game becoming legendary. And the perk system and the leveling system, the progression was just not a part of first-person shooter multiplayer at that time. Were you guys expecting it to take off the way it did?
again, I think you have that dream of, you know, the game being popular, and but you never know. I don't think you're ever ready for that level of success where it just becomes, you know, it kind of took over. It was the game that now everybody had to buy every year because your friends were all playing it, and it's a given. So I don't think anyone's ever ready for that.
Like, was there ever a moment for you where, if you're out at a mall, like maybe you pop into a GameStop and somebody recognized, was there ever a moment where it just sort of hit you of how big Call of Duty had become?
Yeah, I think it happens, you know, from time to time. I think even today, you know, or something, there'll be, I see it somewhere or see it mentioned, you know, from people that you wouldn't think would know games at all, you know.
Yeah.
Or if I'll talk to people and, you know, I'll tell them what I do and they say, oh, I don't really know video games. Call of Duty? Oh, of course I know Call of Duty. It's kind of like it's reached such a level.
Yeah. Can you take me back? So, you know, we get to Modern Warfare 2, also enormous, that just builds on the success of Modern Warfare 1. Things are bigger than ever. Is there pressure at that point? I'm talking about just internally with yourselves, forgetting about Activision or the public or anywhere else. Are you guys thinking, because that's, you know, you come into work and you're on to your next project, which at that point is Modern Warfare 2, and Modern Warfare has taken off. Are you guys sitting around going, what do we do now? How do we top this?
No, I think, you know, when you're kind of developing a game, it's very creative. A lot of ideas come out. You have a lot of things that you kind of get to and you can do really well and you hone them into this experience. And there's just naturally a lot of things left on the table that you didn't have time to explore or didn't get to yet. Or so I think you finish up one game, especially, you know, being a sequel, you just have 100 ideas just already ready to go that you're just thinking, how can I push this in? What can I, you know, make this, how can I make this work? So I think you start off with like a real hunger for the next thing. How can I get there?
Do you get, when you're starting on that, do you now have basically, not that you didn't before, but do you have like ultra carte blanche from as far as the budget goes? Can you just kind of ask for anything and get it and be able to, you know, just have a little, even more freedom than you may have before?
I don't know, because we never really approached it like that. We were always very strict with, you know, with our what our budget was and our time frame. It was, you know, we didn't overspend. You know, we made very cost-effective games because our team was relatively small, and we got them done on time.
Yeah, every 2 years, like clockwork, you guys did do it, get a polished, excellent game out.
Yeah. And it was funny. I think, you know, as time goes on and on, the games get bigger and bigger. There's a lot more assets that you need to create and a lot more, you know, so the games have gotten bigger, the teams have gotten bigger.
A thing that that I always kind of cracked up at looking at the fine print on your Call of Duty games is up until your last one, up through Modern Warfare 2, it was actually based on the Quake 3 engine, right? I mean, I'm sure you guys had pretty much gutted everything, but...
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. So wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
The whole thing started as a licensed Quake 3 engine game.
That's right. Even Modern Warfare 2 shipped with some of that in there.
What was kind of id Software Tech the obvious choice back then? I guess it was sort of. Did you consider Unreal or any of the other ones when you're building Call of Duty?
You know, I think a lot of our guys came from a Quake modding background, and we had worked with that engine in the past, so it made sense for us to go with it. It was a good engine to modify. It was fast. It just felt good.
Was John Carmack lining his pockets every time you guys shipped a billion-dollar Call of Duty game, just with his little piece?
We had a pretty good deal. At some point, we just bought the engine out.
Yeah,
and they made some money, as they should.
Sure,
it was a fantastic tech, and it helped us get the game done.
Makes sense. So then in Modern Warfare 2, then of course we get to the very newsworthy event that you found yourself wrapped up in, and that was your last day at Infinity War. Can you take me back to your last day and tell me a little bit about it? Was it expected? I just want to kind of turn the floor over to you and see if, it's been a while. I'm wondering, as I think people, I'm certainly curious. What that was like to go through for you?
Yeah, that was a while ago now, 6-7 years, right? Expected, yes and no, I guess. You kind of, in the back of your head, things aren't going well.
Yeah.
But it's always a bit of a surprise when it comes to that level, So.
The reports were that you were ushered out of the building.
We actually went down to Activision headquarters to meet with them,
and then
we were ushered out of there, and we were not allowed to go back to Infinity Ward.
Wow! So, were you expecting it?
Like I said, it was. It's possible, but it's still unbelievable when it actually happens. It's still kind of stunning.
In the aftermath of that, did a lot of developer friends reach out to you with support, or is it kind of Vince is a little radioactive right now? Maybe I should stay away.
No, there was a lot of support. There was a lot of people that were. I think some people just wanted to find out what happened and see if it was true, and some people were being thoughtful and offering support as well.
Did a lot of publishers pick up the phone and call you? I'm thinking, hey, if Vince Zampella and potentially his crew at Infinity Ward are free agents. These guys just have created a $1 billion franchise. I should sign these guys up. Is your phone ringing off the hook?
Yeah, we received quite a lot of calls. So that was very, very happy to see that.
Does that, I mean, does it even, make you feel better at that point, or is it just...
It does, yeah, absolutely.
It does. Good.
Yeah.
Because I would think, I mean, I talked to Marty O'Donnell on this show about his, you know, he was embroiled in a lawsuit with his very longtime employer at Bungie, and he talked about the sort of stress of that.
Yeah.
How did you deal with the... I mean, what was it... stressful for you, or were you? Did you kind of just do the lawyers deal with the stress, or how was that situation for you personally?
Yeah, of course it's stressful. You know, you lose your job, control over kind of what you've been doing. It's, you know, I mean, in this case, a job is most of your life. You know, you put so much into it. So, yeah, it's definitely devastating.
I mean, is there a lot of anger? Do you go see a therapist? Do you just get out of town for a while? Like, I don't mean to, I'm not trying to pry or be, you know,
no,
invasive.
Please.
It's almost just out of a movie or out of a soap opera that I'm kind of curious, like I've known you for a long time since obviously well before all that happened. And I'm just kind of curious, like how you sort of deal with that personally.
Yeah, I think, well, what ended up happening was, you know, we immediately went into, you know, talking to the lawyers, and we filed the lawsuit a few days later, and then we started talking to publishers, and, you know, Seamus was my agent at CAA at the time, and he was talking
Seamus
to all the publishers.
Seamus Blackley, yep. Creator of the original Xbox,
right.
Who went on to do a lot of things, including representing video game creators.
So, he was pushing to get things going. Like, everything just, like, went, like, I think I had a day off.
Yeah.
And then it went straight into, you know, filing a lawsuit, getting a new company going, talking to publishers, having all these meetings, flying around to talk to different people. So, it was like, I had no time to really process.
Wow. So you don't even kind of just, like, go out of town, or there's no time for yourself to process this?
Nope.
It's just straight.
I meant to take a break at some point, and I think I will. I haven't yet, but I think I will maybe after we ship Titanfall 2.
I mean, would you have any advice for yourself? Like, if you could go back in time now, would you have any advice for yourself on managing it, or do you feel like you kind of got through it okay?
I think I got through it okay. I mean, sometimes a break sounds nice, but other times maybe that's, you know, what are you just going to sit around and be miserable and
right.
worry about what's going to happen?
Right.
Or you can just get up and make things happen.
Which you did. So. You started Respawn pretty quickly, but, I mean, how did your family react? I promise I'll move on from on to happier times, but like, do you come home and just have to explain the situation?
I did. I mean, especially I worried that, like, you know, my kids would hear it, you know, from other kids at school or something
yeah.
like that, because the news had kind of gotten around, you know, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So I kind of just set them down and, you know, let them know what happened. And, you know, I think they were a little worried, like, what does this mean for us? And, you know, my answer was, you know, don't worry, I'll take care of it.
And
seemed
and
to go all right.
Out. Good. So Respawn, 2010. A lot of the team came with you. A lot of them. I don't know if the official numbers were released, but it was a substantial portion of them from everything I could find.
I recognized a lot of people that sent in resumes. It was happy times.
Did that showing make you feel good? Did that
absolutely.
That showing of loyalty?
Absolutely.
Can
yeah,
you,
I mean, how do you, yeah, I don't know how you even process that. It's, you know, we opened up the company, it was just Jason and I, we
yeah.
started the company, we didn't know what the reaction would be. You know, some of it's based on probably how well Activision was treating the people and what they were doing to try to lock them down, and, you know,
right.
you never know what's going to happen. And for us to get that much interest was, yeah, it floored me.
So does that spur a wave of just ideas? Are you guys all like, I would have to think that in that sort of strange dark period, but you've now birthed this new thing, and was the energy just more vibrant than ever for you and your team?
I would say it was an odd period, because I think we never intended to grow that fast. But when you have, you know, these amazing developers that you worked with, you have this relationship with, that want to come with you,
yeah.
you take them. You know, you're not going to pass that up. I'm not an idiot.
But
we had, you know, a big team. We were like up to 43, 44 people, something like that, you know, in a month.
Right.
With
no game.
With no game yet. No idea, no anything. So it was, okay, now let's all sit down and try to figure out what this game is. And you remember those 42 people or whatever also filed their own lawsuit against Activision. So I think we were all, there was a mixed energy of, you know, this weird lawsuit distraction and this, you know, great energy of, you know, we want to make a game. And what those ideas were, you know, ranged all over the board. So there wasn't a, you know, a, here's the game we're going to make. It was throw out ideas, argue over it, fight over it, and have meetings about the lawsuit on the side over here. And so it was a strange time.
Was, since, you know, you sort of admitted to a little FU mode, Vince, from in early Infinity Ward, with Medal of Honor. Were the group of you kind of in FU mode when the company started?
No, not really. I think some of it was just, you know, trying to do something different. We wanted to stay away. I mean,
it'd be human nature if you were.
But Call of Duty is like my baby, you know? Yeah. I helped create it. I don't want to see it die.
Right.
You know? I want to make something different. I want to make something, you know, new and bring a new game to people, so.
And that game was Titanfall. I'm curious, how quickly did you and the team hit on, first, the name Respawn, because obviously it's perfect under the circumstances. Do you remember who specifically thought of it? And then take me to how long it took you guys to hit on the Titanfall concept.
Jason and I were kicking names back and forth, and there was a couple, I don't even remember what they were, so don't ask. I remember some of them, but I won't say it. And then when that one came out, it was just like, yes, that's perfect. Like you said, it just kind of like, it hits you like, yeah, that's the name.
Yeah.
There was no discussion after that point.
Well, so and then how about Titanfall itself? How long were you guys sort of kicking around ideas, and then where does Titanfall come from?
I'm always bad with timing on stuff like this. It just kind of all melds together. It was a while. We were, you know, kicking ideas around back and forth. It was probably a year before we really...
A year of... You've got 40-something people and no game for a year.
Well, we have games. We have things we're trying. We have, you know,
prototypes
and different things. And before we settled on what the core of the game was, though, yeah.
Interesting. So... let's talk about Titanfall, and that's because making a new IP, especially these days, is extremely hard. I mean, as you know better than anybody, that game budgets are bigger than ever, and it's, you know, people, it's almost seemingly to me a little synonymous with film. It's like you're either a big budget franchise or you're a little indie thing, and there's not a lot of room in between. So, making a new IP, it's tough to get it to catch on, but you guys did it, and we were very successful. How do you feel about Titanfall 1 in hindsight now as we're recording here on the eve of Titanfall 2's release?
I love Titanfall 1. You know, it's not a perfect game, but there's so much in it that we got to experiment with and kind of try new things. The decision to go multiplayer only was actually, that was a tough one that we kind of did agonize over.
I was going to ask you about that next, yeah.
So that was, you know, a decision that we made to try to take the story elements and put them in, kind of weave them into multiplayer, because it was something new. You know,
right.
It was that desire to really just express ourselves in a different way. So I think we did that successfully. It's still not a single player campaign. So it's great to be able to now bring a new single player campaign to the table. So
right. But, well, yeah, with two now, you guys are, it's full blown single player campaign.
Full blown.
I think a lot of gamers, especially maybe younger ones who maybe they do play Call of Duty every year, they don't realize that the core crew behind the Call of Duty, you know, they love is actually your crew, and that is so. It's really your team's first single player campaign in
since
7
Modern Warfare
years?
2, yeah,
7 years. So what you guys seem to have this whatever the secret sauce is to making a good single player or first person shooter campaign. You guys seem to have it because a lot of games this generation, shooters, have either had a real bad one or have actually skipped it altogether and just said, forget it, we're just doing multiplayer only, I mean, including Titanfall 1. So what is your secret? What is the secret to making a good
shooter? I don't know that there is a secret.
Campaign?
I think we're a passionate team, and when we have the time to find the right idea and iterate on it and experiment and try something new, and it just, you know, it's talent, I guess, would be the only secret. The team here is amazing. I couldn't be more proud of what they've done.
What was so? How about what was? Let's try and dig into this a little. What was what was Modern Warfare's secret to its campaign being so good? I mean, I have my opinion on it, but what's your opinion? What do you think as the guy who made it?
It's a mix. Like I said, it's the team putting the details into a story that we care about and we believe in, and I don't know. It's a passion. I think you have to have the passion for it. This team does.
So with Titanfall 2, I mean, a lot of people will probably watch this after they've already played it, so they'll at least have a basis for it. I haven't played it yet, so I'm coming at this blind a little bit. But
we should fix that.
Well, we are here, aren't we? Maybe we can. But what's so?
It's really good.
That's what everybody around here says. So it's a lot to live up to.
Yeah, we're not biased at all.
I would hope you would say you would love it. If you were all like, I hope you like this single-player campaign, that would worry me if you were all just kind of like, well, I hope you like it. But what's sort of the new... Is there sort of a philosophy that you guys hit on for Titanfall 2's campaign that is making everybody around here that I've been talking to today super excited?
I would say... We built the game around the mechanics because, you know, Titanfall 2 is about that fast, fluid gameplay, that verticality, the kind of freedom that makes it hard to make a contained single-player experience.
Yeah, a lot of those are very linear now.
Right, so it's embracing that and making sure that the game doesn't break that and building, you know, something, again, just putting the passion into what we believe in and the game... The way the story and the game and the world just all work around the mechanics so well.
I got to back up a quick second and ask you about, you partnered up with Microsoft for Titanfall 1. You were a third-party console exclusive. And then I feel like, if I'm remembering right, on Twitter at one point, you even seemed surprised that it wasn't that Titanfall 1 wasn't going to come to PS4.
Yeah, that was unfortunate.
So...
Well,
what happened there?
Well, the intention was always, you know, we're a small team.
Yeah.
Doing a new IP. Like you said, it's hard. Doing one platform for launch was always intended. Microsoft, fantastic partner for us. We couldn't have done it without them. So, and I want to get that clear that out of the way. There was no animosity there. It was just we always envisioned at some point being able to take it over to PlayStation. Didn't happen, but it will now.
Because Titanfall 2 business reasons, I guess.
Now, yeah, it was a deal that EA made with Microsoft.
Okay.
So,
was there any thought?
It worked in our favor in a lot of ways, so it wasn't entirely one-sided.
Sure.
But it's now to be able to get it to all the gamers is important to us. You know, we make something that we want as many people as possible to play and experience.
I mean, was there any thought given to? I mean, like we've seen, some games are doing. Like here, if you pre-order the new game, here's we brought the old one over to the whatever the new platform is, and this is usually the console generation. I mean, have you guys thought about just go ahead and bringing Titanfall 1 over to PS4, even to kind of as like a bonus or a little extra thing for PS4 owners?
I believe we are limited in our ability to do that.
Gotcha. All right, so back to business things. Fair enough. Although, does Titanfall 2 just kind of overwrite? Do you feel like that way, actually? That does Titanfall 2 overwrite Titanfall 1?
Definitely doesn't overwrite it. It's a different story. Like, you don't have to have played Titanfall 1 to enjoy, understand Titanfall 2. It's its own contained story and everything, so, and which was important for us, since we hopefully will have a lot of new fans.
Obviously, you talked about how you chose to not have, it was a decision to not have a full-on single-player campaign in Titanfall 1. Do you regret that at all, or does it still feel like everything went the way you're happy with it going?
I think if we had tried to do a single-player campaign back then, we wouldn't have done it as well because we didn't understand or we didn't have a good understanding of how to mold those mechanics into a single-player game that we got post, Titanfall 1 launching. So I don't think the single-player would have been as good had we done it then.
Interesting.
So I think the way it worked out was perfect.
Let's see here. What do you see Titanfall as a trilogy, as a permanent thing that'll just go on forever? Do you see it as a, as a TV series, as a feature film? What do you kind of hope and dream for it?
I mean, we don't have necessarily a trilogy in mind. you always hope when you create something that it's, you know, embraced and that, you know, people will love it for generations to come, you know. So I hope we do more of it. You know, we probably plan to do more. You know, we have the mobile games as well.
Yep.
So I would like to see the universe live on. I think it's very expandable. I think there's a lot we can do with it. There's a lot of great ideas floating around here that I would love to see come to life.
Excellent.
So
we'll be here. We'll be ready for them. A couple more for you, and then I will let you go, I promise, because I'm sure you want to actually go finish your video game, probably. That's people don't – they want you to finish it instead of talk to me. you guys are doing a third-person Star Wars game upstairs from where we're sitting, and that news was I think, a little unexpected for most gamers because, obviously, your crew's background is not in neither Star Wars nor in third-person action games. So I'm kind of curious, who approached who? Did you know, you obviously have a established business relationship with EA, and they have the Star Wars video game license. So did they bring that to you guys, or did you kind of go, hey, wait a minute, we know EA, and they have a they got the license, so let's hit them up.
You know, I was talking to the guys at Bad Robot when they were working on Force Awakens, and they were huge fans of Call of Duty and Allied Assault, and they were, you know, just like pushing, like, you guys need to do a Star Wars game. And, you know, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. You know, I grew up with it. It's part of my DNA, yeah. I guess. I brought Stig over from, he worked at Sony on God of War. Mm-hmm. He's also a huge Star Wars fan. He and I talked about, you know, like, wouldn't it be amazing if we could do this Star Wars game? We talked to EA about it initially. Didn't look like it was going to happen. Hmm. So we actually, you know, moved on. We started creating an original IP with that team. And EA came back, you know, not that long ago, I guess, a year ago or something, and said, wait a minute, maybe we do want you to do a Star Wars game. And we were able to work it out. And, yeah, we couldn't be more excited. Yeah,
so
it's a great team.
Is it are you directly involved in that one, or
Stig is the game director, and you know I'll help out any way I can.
Is that sort of what you envision as the future of Respawn? Is multiple teams, multiple projects, and it doesn't always have to be you being, you know, super hands on and nose to the grindstone all the time?
Yeah, I think, you know, us having the ability for multiple teams for people to maybe, hey, I've worked on three Titanfall games. I want to go over here and try, you know, something new.
Yeah.
Having an opportunity for people to try out new things, express themselves creatively in a different way, in a different type of game, like you said, third person versus first,
right,
on a different franchise, maybe, you know, grow themselves. You know, if we don't have room for them to grow in their career, maybe they can on another team. So I think having multiple teams is really important for us as a studio as we kind of grow and try to embrace more gaming.
I would have thought that the Bad Robot sort of endorsement would have carried a lot more weight with when you guys were initially trying to get that Star Wars deal done.
Well, it worked out.
But
in
it
the
worked
end,
out.
So.
Yes. Last question I have for you, Vince, and that's, as a guy who's built three large video game franchises and counting so far between Medal of Honor, Call of Duty, and Titanfall. What are your goals for the next 5 to 10 years of your career?
Wow. I think it's just continue to build Respawn into a place where people can express themselves, do something they love, and get rewarded well for it, and have growth, and have the studio just be an amazing place to work. Like, I want the studio to be something that people are proud to come here every day to.
Vince, thank you so much for inviting us down. It's
my pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And the game is out. Titanfall 2 may be out now, depending when you're watching this, but October 2016 is the date. We look forward to playing the first single-player campaign from your crew in quite some time, and, of course, the evolution of Titanfall multiplayer. So, Vince, thanks again, and for much more from the best, brightest, most interesting, fascinating folks in the video game industry, such as Vince Zampella. Be sure to stay tuned each and every month for a new episode of IGN Unfiltered.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
You need to save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.